Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, an original, in-depth investigative report. It is published in four sections. It is called Death by Medicine. My co-author on this is Helen Beniski, and we want you to know that prior to getting into the report itself, I'd like to give you a little context so that we can think on this and have a discussion that is meaningful. Up to this point, we've been told what's good for us. We have not been allowed to question. Even if we could, we frequently do not have the scientific background to make judgments upon the latest drugs, whether they're statin drugs for elevated cholesterol or antipsychotic or antidepressant medications for people with depression and anxiety or non-steroidal anti-inflammatories for arthritis or pain or digestive problems, having digestive. In fact, there are thousands of drugs available for us. We've been told that these are safe and effective. They've been passed by the Food and Drug Administration, and there's always the watchful eye of the CDC that is looking at this, all under the umbrella of the U.S. Public Health Services, along with the National Cancer Institute and the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Disease, the National Institute for Anti-Aging Medicine. As a result, we have confidence that what we're given is the best that could be given at any given time in medical procedures. And therefore, when the Obama administration brought forth their program to help with those who were uninsured and to lower the premiums of those who were insured and get even greater coverage, especially for pre-existing medical conditions that might otherwise have been excluded and leading to extreme financial hardship, including in the last 20 years, bankruptcy from medical bills have been either the first, second, or third most common reason for bankruptcy in the United States at the personal level. Obamacare, however, was a fraud at every level. It was not put together by outside physicians and specialists and scientists who are independent, who have no political, ideological, or financial association with hospital, the drug companies, the insurance companies, or anything for profit within the industry. Had that been the case, then you would have seen thousands of highly qualified men and women coming forward and talking about what would be the best medical practices we could engage in, what would be the best medical curriculums, what should people be studying, and how should the patient best be treated. But none of that existed. Virtually every line of Obamacare was written, the Affordable Care Act, by lobbyists and attorneys and executives from the insurance industry. In spite of all that was said, there were still between 16 million and 22 million people who remained uninsured. In spite of what was said, premiums went up, not down. People were still excluded from procedures that could cause bankruptcy. But most importantly, and this is why this investigative report is so important for everyone, especially when we're considering and hopefully will implement some form of universal health care, no one was questioning, let's say that you are fully insured, therefore you can receive any medical procedure that your physician or hospital or a team of specialists deems fit. What if they're wrong? What if that particular procedure, that drug, is not only not beneficial, but could actually lead to your injury or death? And if that were the case, wouldn't there be alarms raised? Wouldn't we stop for a moment and say, we're putting massive numbers of individuals at risk? For what? For profit? Surely we are more humane. We are wiser than that, putting profits above people. You'd be sorely disappointed. Our investigation, which began over 15 years ago with Dr. Martin Feldman and four other PhD and MDs, it took us 5 years of methodical research using only and exclusively peer-reviewed literature from different medical organizations. So when we were looking at the benefits or limitations of cancer therapy, we only looked at the peer-reviewed literature that the oncologists, radiologists, and surgeons were using. The same would be true for depression and anxiety disorders We only looked at the literature that was considered the best literature from the mental health field. Cardiology, the same. Gastroenterology, endocrinology, neurology. So we looked at only their statistics, and we were appalled. When our study was finished, we sent it to 7,000 medical organizations, all the major ones, the American Medical Association. We sent it to The Lancet, the British Medical Journal, New England Journal of Health, Nature, Science Magazine. Plus, we sent it to all the news media. We sent it to every health reporter we could find in the United States. In the next 5 years, we did not have a single response. It's okay if someone says, well, we challenge your figures. Fine, which figures? We have full references to our scholarship. But no one asked any question. It was as if, for the first time, we were exposing something that was such a sacred cow that it was heretical to even consider that we had been putting millions of people per year at risk. Our statistics showed at the end that the number one cause of death was not heart disease, including stroke or cancer or diabetes. It was iatrogenesis, a medical induced. The number one cause of injury was the same. Now, the American Medical Association, to its credit, did such a study and said that iatrogenic or medically induced death was the third leading cause of death. When we reviewed their work, we found that it was grossly negligent, not surprising, that they had not included such things as in-hospital infections the person developed inside the hospital, like bed sores that led to over 80,000 deaths in 1 year, and gangrene and limb amputations, malnutrition that a person died from, 50,000 in 1 year, that they did not have going into the hospital, but they developed that malnutrition inside the hospital and died. So when you added up all of our statistics, it was more accurate, and it was number one. So what would you do if you were the average physician and now someone showed you medically, scientifically valid information from your own journals, your own societies, the government's own statistics, that the medicine you were practicing was neither safe nor effective for a lot of your patients? What would you do? Would you change? Would you demand investigations? Would you reverse procedures? 900,000 doctors remained silent. The small number, under 1%, who chose to challenge the prevailing medical dogma went off to practice what is known as complementary or alternative or holistic medicine. And instead of hurting the patients, their patients were getting better. They could still use anything from their orthodox arsenal, but in this case, they were using a much broader-based approach, looking at the entirety of the person. And as a result, they gave more time to the patients. They looked at lifestyle modification, proper diet, exercise, stress management, nutrient deficiencies being overcome. And instead of being appreciated for the new path they were taking, they were criticized and condemned. The leading source of their condemnation was Wikipedia and a group of individuals with no qualifications in the field that they were judging. In fact, in one case, it was a person leading a skeptic group's only qualifications is that they were hanging paintings in a store. No PhDs, no MDs in the sciences, no peer-reviewed journals, no background in dietetic sciences, emergency medicine, nothing. And frequently they were anonymous. So just imagine how that could go wrong. Anonymous people with no skills, no background, but with a political or economic agenda hidden from the public, able to smear, demean, deface the entire field of alternative or complementary medicine. And then they went further, trying to destroy chiropractic, homeopathy, body-mind medicine, meditation, yoga, proper diet. So when we looked at everything, doing an update of that original work, once again we used only their statistics. So now put this into a current context. Universal health care is the only humanistic way of approaching the many people who are suffering or not being properly treated or treated at all. So shouldn't we start by asking a basic question? If everybody's able to be treated with universal health care, how do we know that what we're treating them with is the best approach to take? What if we're actually putting them at greater risk by using therapies that are known to be flawed in safety and efficacy? And it's not only will they not get better, there's a probability they will be injured or dead because it's happening year after year. We're talking about tens of millions of deaths over the last half century, hundreds of millions of injuries. And not a single meeting that we could find by any of the health regulators, the Surgeon General, the head of the U.S. Public Health Service, the President's special advisors on health care, saying, hold on, shouldn't we at least discuss this? So it says a lot about who is in control, who has captured regulatory agencies, medical schools, the curriculum, the insurance industry. So our belief is that we should look carefully at the therapies that would be provided under universal health care, including a large emphasis upon prevention. And right now we have zero prevention in the United States. To the contrary, the mainstream media, abetted by the government regulatory agencies, promotes foods and beverages that are known to cause disease. And rarely do you ever see any ad that encourages a healthy lifestyle. So that is a question that must be addressed. If we have universal health care, shouldn't we start from scratch and provide health care that actually is providing health and simply keeping people over-medicated and excessive medical procedures? By any measure, we are in the worst health crisis in American history. Out of a population of approximately 335 to 337 million people, two-thirds of us, adults and children both, are suffering from a wide range of health conditions, the majority of which are preventable. Our first effort at exploring how serious the conditions were, and indeed to verify that they were really using only mainstream medical community efforts and the government official figures, took several years with a group of highly qualified board-certified physicians and academics with PhDs with deep experience in research to verify this, that the government was not improving our health. The government was not providing mandates that actually would allow people to live longer and healthier lives. Up until that point, no one had compiled all injuries and fatalities occurring as a result of medical treatment. The best that had been done was by a professor, Lucien Lippi, a professor from Harvard University, who had written a groundbreaking report that had done virtually unimaginably qualified work. And it went unchallenged. It also went unreported in the medical press. Later, the Journal of the American Medical Association would publish an article by Dr. Barbara Starfield showing that iatrogenesis was the third leading cause of death. And Dr. Martin Makary researched the same conclusions and over a decade later, publishing his findings in the British Medical Journal. However, it was surprising and disheartening to find that with all the medical and scientific research expertise at these researchers' disposal, they left out several important causes of death from their statistics. This shows gross flaws in their research methodology. Our report was the most comprehensive to date published in the United States. Once completed, we sent it for feedback, and as I mentioned at the beginning of this program, and comment over 7,000 scientific publications, health reporters, and federal agencies, not one single response was received. How is that even possible? We expected legitimate challenges and corrections if need be. Even admonitions would have been welcome. Instead, we got dead silence. Total silence. Why? Years have passed, and the state of American health has only worsened. The latest official report shows more heart attacks, more strokes, more obesity, more diabetes, including in children, more dementia, more Alzheimer's, more cancer than ever before. And yet we spent more on health care in 2018 and now in 2019 than we've ever spent. Over $3.5 trillion, that's 17.9% of the nation's gross domestic product, and a number that is on track to further increase into 2019 and 20. So now we're perplexed. If we tell people that we have the best healthcare system in the world, with the latest technology, the most pharmaceuticals and medical procedures, state-of-the-art hospitals and special treatment centers, isn't it reasonable to assume that we should have a population that is far more robust and healthy, living longer lives? But it's just the opposite. Then it occurred to us that we were also missing a very important piece of this puzzle. Why are we not preventing disease? How much is all this disease actually costing the patient, corporations, and societies? The figures are both staggering and heartbreaking, as there is no discussion whatsoever anywhere on this topic. We only become invested in a person after they're sick. We have only focused on a society on how to alleviate the symptoms of a person's illness. When we compare our health programs and the state of health and longevity with other developed nations, we are always dead last. How is that possible? Those individuals who've brought these dire statistics to our attention have initiated no wider call for action. Nothing has happened. They, too, have been shouting into the wind. This is a dialogue we desperately need. Our new article expands on the first to include a discussion of iatrogenesis, its causes, prevention, and most importantly, how to resolve, in part or whole, all of these problems. Let's look at the cost. The Harvard professor, the first well-known physician to bring the iatrogenesis problem into the limelight, only to be largely ignored by the medical community, notes that while some progress has been made, the situation is by no means resolved. Indeed, it has gotten much worse since 2009, when he did his report. Thanks to skyrocketing premiums introduced by the Affordable Care Act and unaccompanied by an increase in quality of care. Depending upon the study, medical errors is estimated to cost anywhere from $200 to $980 billion a year. That's a significant sum by any measure. Our calculations place those costs somewhere in the middle, at upwards of $440 billion. But that is probably a low estimate, given how few of the medical errors that take place are ever reported, and our statistics are only based upon people who come to hospitals or die in hospitals or are manifesting injuries in hospitals. What about all the people who have a procedure and go home and then end up with all forms of side effects or injuries or death while at home? Unfortunately, those figures are not to be found anywhere. What about when everything goes according to plan? That $440 billion is a mere drop in the bucket compared to the staggering $3.5 trillion of the U.S. gross domestic product. That's more than twice the amount the next two countries spend on health care combined. According to a study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association earlier this year, that compared the U.S. with 10 other wealthy countries, we spend more than 400% on administrative cost, up to 300% more on pharmaceuticals, and yet achieve the lowest life expectancy out of all the countries measured, with the average American living just 78.8 years, while the mean of all the other 11 countries is almost 82 years. That's a substantial difference. We also have the highest infant mortality rate at 8.5 deaths per thousand live births. According to the CDC, which does not track iatrogenic deaths, heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, accounting for one in every four deaths and killing almost 634,000 Americans in just one recent year. When you add the deaths from stroke to the total, the number climbs to nearly 800,000, amounting to one in three Americans' lives lost every year. Heart disease and strokes cost the nation about $555 billion per year in health care services and medications and lost productivity. The American Heart Association believes these costs would double in just the next 20 years or less, a possibility that, quote, could bankrupt our nation's economy and health care system, according to its president, Dr. Stephen Hauser. Quote, the fact that cardiovascular disease could single-handedly bankrupt our nation's health care system is disturbing, but it's a real possibility if we don't act soon to do a better job of preventing what are largely preventable disorders. We would agree. In our medical system, however, doctors are not rewarded for preventing diseases. There's no medical billing code for a clean bill of health. Doctors who keep their patients out of the hospital are, if anything, punished by being deprived of the cash that flows to their peers in in-demand specialty fields like oncology and cardiology. Thus, expecting doctors to shift to a preventative care model without also fixing a system that only rewards treatment of the already sick is expecting doctors to take food out of their own mouths. Cancer is the second leading cause of death, according to the CDC, killing 595,930 Americans in just one recent year. Direct medical costs were $80 billion, and because more people develop cancer every year, total care costs are expected to reach $173 billion within the next 6 to 9 months. While not as financially devastating as heart disease, this is another condition we are exacerbating as a society by failing to address the causes or arrest the onset of the disease until the patient is already sick. All this suffering and expenditure could be avoided if the profit motive was removed from health care. But too many people are benefiting on too many levels from the current model of meaningful change to be enacted. Since the publication of the original Death by Medicine 2009, other reports have periodically surfaced to remind the medical industry of the scope of the iatrogenesis problem. Like ours, these warnings have gone largely unheeded, sinking without a trace in the ever-widening money pool of medical spending. In 2016, Dr. Martin Makary of Johns Hopkins University wrote to Dr. Thomas Frieden, director of the Center for Disease Control, to request an agency include medical error on its list of causes of death published every year. Makary has published a study earlier that year in the British Medical Journal revealing that a minimum of 251,454 deaths are attributable to medical error every year. He emphasized that this figure was a low estimate because it only included patients who died in hospitals and did not include outpatients or deaths that occurred after discharge. In his letter, Makary and his colleagues merely requested the CDC allow clinicians to list medical error as a cause of death on death certificates, given its prevalence. The current model limits recording options to disease, morbid conditions, and injuries as itemized by the International Classification of Disease Billing Codes, which causes not found on that list those he calls human and system factors in medical care. They're all excluded. He recommends an additional field on death certificates that would indicate whether preventable complications of medical care were primary to the cause of death, allowing a fuller picture of the circumstances without necessarily creating a legal liability. Bringing the high rate of medical error into the open, Makary hopes will bring to bear the forces needed to begin to solve the problem. Government funding flows to cancer and heart disease research while medical error is a forgotten backwater discussed only in hospital committees, the proverbial elephant in the room sucking up all the air while the medical profession hesitates to even speak its name. Being able to share best practices and avoid worst practices can only help both patients and doctors. Sunlight is the best disinfectant, literally, in this case. He received no response from the CDC. The professor from Harvard, who was honored by the National Patient Safety Foundation in 2007 with the founding of the Lucien Lepay Institute to study healthcare safety, is losing patience with the industries he's worked in all of his professional life. Quote, "It's incomprehensible to me that hospitals can continue to not follow practices that are known to make a real difference." He told health leaders, he believes a depoliticized regulatory agency, he uses the Federal Aviation Agency as a model, is the solution to the medical industry's problems. A group with powers to inspect and discipline, but no conflicts of interest to prevent them from doing their job. And he suggests regulators not underestimate the value of shaming, public reporting, and encouraging compliance with safety standards. Like Meckery, Lepay believes it's time to leave the Institute of Medicine's figures of 98,000 iatrogenic deaths behind and adopt a more realistic number. NASA toxicologist John T. James estimates 440,000 deaths caused by medical error per year is supported by these and other experts. However, they admit that even the global trigger toll James used does not catch all medical errors, particularly those that represent actions that should have been taken but weren't. The true number of medically induced deaths is probably much higher. Indeed, our calculations found it to be more than double James's statistic. Yet the medical industry forges ahead with business as usual, in which they take credit for all healing but eschew responsibility for all complications, up to and including death. They cannot have it both ways, yet that has been what they've done. An individual who receives the flu vaccine and does not get the flu is not praised for living healthy and changing their lifestyle, adhering to a healthy plant-based diet, exercising every day, and getting enough sleep. But if he does get the flu, it must have been something he did. Writ large, this is the story of the entire medical system. So let me put this a little simpler. Let's just say that you're living in Florida. You're getting outdoors, you're exercising, you're getting sunlight, you're not stressed, there's no pollution in the air, you have access to lots of fruits and vegetables, your own home garden. You're living a life of ease. You've deserved it, and you're enjoying it. And so you don't get the flu. Will you receive the credit for not getting the flu? Absolutely not. But let's say that you live in upstate Maine, and there's been a particularly challenging winter, heavy snows, bleak, cold, not a lot of sunlight, but you got the flu vaccine. And let's say that you decided to do something about it. So you started taking vitamin D and vitamin C capsules. You began to exercise indoors. You began to read and relax and do some yoga, meditation, even juice, take some herbal teas, and eat a plant-based diet. At the end of the year, you did not get the flu. It is only the flu vaccine that will be given credit. Nothing that you did will be considered a value. That's how bad the science is, and that's how manipulative it is at the same time. So, Dr. Hayter Warrick, a cardiologist at Duke University, published an editorial in the New York Times that epitomizes this head-in-the-sand approach to medical harms. He reflectively defends ineffective treatments the medical establishment is starting to cast aside while dismissing patients who seek to better understand their condition by doing their research. He calls them gullible and superstitious peasants who need a medical specialist like him to lead them out of the wilderness. The graphic that accompanies his op-ed says it all. An angry-looking, overweight woman depicted in red tones, her face lit up even redder in the glow of her iPhone, towering over a white-coated doctor one-third her size. Patients who research the treatments prescribed for them, even though they are clearly unhealthy and in need of healing, are questioning the received wisdom of the doctor as interpreter of divine will. They are effectively cheating on him with their iPhones, and that's unforgivable. Even though the major scientific journals publish their studies online, the internet is reduced to a swamp of false information, sure to lead the patient off the shining path illuminated by the medical profession. That doctor focuses on statins in his medical orthodoxy. He describes a patient who has a minor heart attack after neglecting to take her medication because of, quote, scary things she had read about statins on the internet, claiming any of the drug's adverse effects can be ascribed to nocebo effect. He then defends the drugs and even promises criminalizing the spread of information about their harms. In 2015, Diamond and Ravitsky destroyed the case for statins with a seminal article in the Expert Review of Clinical Pharmacology that deconstructs how Americans were tricked into embracing statins as a miracle drug for preventing heart attacks, while they acknowledged the effectiveness of the drugs in lowering cholesterol levels. They call into question, on the whole, accepted wisdom that high cholesterol is a causative factor in cardiovascular disease. The researchers cite dozens of studies published in peer-reviewed medical literature and online, a diabolically clever campaign of statistical deception using a statistical tool called relative risk reduction. During the 2008 Juniper trial of a Crestor by AstraZeneca, which sponsored the study, a minuscule difference in the rate of heart attacks between the control and the drug groups was recast statistically as an impressive drug effect, even though more people actually died of heart attacks while using the drug than the control group. Quote, regarding fatal and non-fatal cardiovascular disease, less than 0.5% of the treated population benefited from the drug, and 244 people needed to be treated to prevent a single fatal or non-fatal heart attack. Despite this meager effect, in the media the benefits were stated as, quote, more than 50% avoided a fatal heart attack. Worse, the drug group displayed an increase in diabetes. Although the number of incidences were small, they were not treated to the same statistical magic as the dip in heart attacks of 0.5%. A patient's cancer risk increases with statin treatment, and a link with central nervous system disease has also emerged. More than one statin trial ended with an increase in suicidal or violent deaths among subjects treated with the drug. The researchers note that low blood cholesterol levels are prevalent among, quote, criminals and people with diagnosis of violent and aggressive conduct disorders and homicidal offenders with histories of violence and suicidal attempts related to alcohol and in people with poor internalized social norms and self-control, as well as other psychiatric disorders. Cognitive problems were closely linked with statin treatment, to the extent that discontinuing the drugs often alleviates the symptoms. A Dr. Padala and associates tested their hypothesis in a study by discontinuing statins in a group of patients with Alzheimer's disease. 12 weeks later, the study's participants were performing markedly better on cognitive tests. When placed back on the statins, their cognition deteriorated to its previous level. Statins deplete the body of coenzyme Q10 and selenium, two essential nutrients required for proper heart and nerve function. Coenzyme Q10 deficiency manifests in the muscle and joint pain experienced by many statin patients and contributes to aging, as the nutrient is a powerful antioxidant that normally protects DNA from free radical damage. As statins lower the body's coenzyme Q10 levels, heart and nerve function decline. The consequence is the neurodegeneration side effects of statins the medical-industrial complex has unsuccessfully tried to sweep under the rug. These are not mere chance events unrelated to the actions of the drugs, nor are they nocebo effects conjured through the black magic of internet research. The packaging and selling of statins to healthy people as anti-atherosclerotic insurance is one of the most egregious frauds perpetrated on the American public in recent decades. A advisory by the cholesterol treatment trialist collaborators suggested expanding the pool of patients recommended for statin therapy, and since even the least at-risk population could be shown using the aforementioned statistical trickery to benefit, while a revised shifted the primary treatment criteria from LDL-C levels to a risk assessment that takes into account other health factors for individual patients, this refactoring had the effect of increasing the number of Americans taking statins, not decreasing it. By 2016, fully half of men aged 60 and older were taking statins, up from 36% just 10 years before. The percentage of women taking the drugs has increased more slowly, from 33 to 38%. Further, revision of treatment guidelines issued by the American Heart Association earlier this year actually emphasized a, quote, heart-healthy lifestyle, end quote, before mentioning statin drugs. This was a monumental shift given the exclusivity of the pharmaceutical focus of most of American medicine. Yet, as the doctor does not utter a word in favor of lifestyle measure, such as plant-based low-calorie diet and exercise regularly, to posit that such natural interventions might have a beneficial effect on his cardiac patients is heresy to the pharmaceutically faithful. It is not enough that the next 9 points of treatment in the new American Heart Association guidelines deal with when and how to prescribe statins. The doctor and his colleagues cannot monetize a healthy lifestyle, and it is anathema to their pharmaceutical-based view of medicine. That the American Heart Association guidelines for managing cardiovascular disease with cholesterol-lowering therapies even mentions lifestyle challenges at all is an encouraging development. Their common sense recommendations represent an island of sanity in an ocean of big pharma faith healing. Quote, patients should consume a dietary pattern that emphasizes taking of vegetables, fruits, whole grains, legumes, healthy protein, low-fat dairy, low-fat poultry without the skin, fish and nuts, and non-tropical vegetable oils, and limits intakes of sweet, sugar, sweetened beverages, and red meats. This dietary pattern should be adjusted to the appropriate caloric intake requirements. Now, personal and cultural food preferences and nutritional therapies for other medical conditions, including diabetes, caloric intake, should be adjusted to avoid weight gain, or in overweight, obese patients, to promote weight loss in general. Adults should be advised to engage in aerobic physical activity at least 4 sessions a week, lasting an average of 40 minutes per session, and involving moderate to vigorous intensive physical activity. So it seems obvious, and yet it looks decades back. Why did it take 50 years of flawed medical research and policy and practice to reach this point? How many patients have died needlessly because cardiologists wanted to get more people on statins? How many cancer and dementia patients currently in the throes of their illness might have held on to a quality of life a little longer if they hadn't had these drugs pushed upon them. But fake medical news to doctors steeped in the orthodoxy of pharmaceutical-based medical model is more of a menace than the incompetence of their own profession. Similar to fake news in general, the menace has been blown widely out of proportion to the latest trend in fear. Certainly, confirmation bias is also a danger. If a patient is seeking out supporting evidence that their toenail fungus is terminal, they will find it somewhere online. However, the volume of information available to patients on the internet is a valuable resource that should not be trivialized or demonized. Indeed, patients who do their own research before blindly accepting a doctor's recommendations should be commended for taking care of their health. Even CNN, hardly considered a maverick when it comes to medical coverage, suggested patients discuss the risk of statin with their doctors before filling their prescriptions. After a study published in the Annals of Internal Medicine this year suggested that the risks outweighed the benefits when the drugs are prescribed to prevent cardiovascular disease. The doctor in the New York Times editorial moralized that, quote, Silicon Valley needs to own this problem, be held responsible for promoting or hosting fake information, end quote. Is this a call to suppress all criticism of medical modalities he favors? Will he own up to his own field's problems, which are far more numerous and deadly than a few misleading articles, and certainly more detrimental than the looming specter of an informed patient? And while he admits the scientific community has a responsibility to patients to maintain trust and chides a group of National Institutes of Health researchers who published a study on the benefits of moderate drinking funded by big alcohol, he saves most of his venom for the media. After all, the media didn't have to cover that terrible study, did they? One might argue that traditional responsibility for the Fourth Estate is to warn the people when powerful interests are threatening them. But would this doctor, rather journalist, stick to publishing pharmaceutical company press releases? And why should we subscribe to his views? Does he think that we are too dim-witted to make up our own minds about a particular treatment? His ideal patient takes the drugs they are given, regardless of their effects, even when they are contraindicated by published science. Even as official guidelines have shifted away from prescribing statins to treat moderately high cholesterol, and as the medical community is faced with incontrovertible evidence of the drug's negative effects, he stands by his protocol. Why is he so concerned about who's taking statins anyway? Well, it turns out that this doctor is one of the authors of a 2017 study called National Trends in Statin Use and Expenditures in the U.S. Adult Population from 2002 to 2013, published by the Journal of American Medical Association Cardiology. The study decries statin drugs, quote, suboptimal uptake in high-risk groups. Researchers receiving funding from some of the largest pharmaceutical firms, Santa Fe, Novartis, Amgen, and Regeneron. Elsewhere in his op-ed, he scolds Tennessee physician Mark Green, recently elected to Congress, and the congressional candidate was the subject of an epidemic of media pearl-clutching when he responded to a town hall question with assurances that he would, quote, get the real data on vaccines from the CDC. Green stated, quote, there is some concern that the rise in autism is a result of the preservatives that are in our vaccines, end quote. He never declared that vaccines cause autism, as he is being accused of doing, but merely echoed concerns his constituents had shared with him that the data might have been fraudulently managed. Green was forced to eat his words after being torn to pieces by left and right leaning media outlets alike. concerns about the human papilloma vaccine, which had been linked to hundreds of deaths, as well as side effects, including paralysis and sterility, are lamented as benighted superstition, even though there is no evidence the vaccine actually protects against later life cervical and other cancers it is advertised to ward off. By 2014, the CDC had already paid out $6 million to severely injured victims of Merck's Gardasil human papilloma vaccine. Perhaps conceding that the old guard of the medical industrial complex cannot win the battle for hearts and minds with science because the science is not on their side. It's not. So, what are we to do? Who are we to believe? Now, wherever possible, we have updated the statistics used in the original book to reflect more recent studies. However, in many cases, newer figures were not available. The vast majority of medical research is still funded by pharmaceutical companies uninterested in bankrolling an examination of how they are failing patients. Also, I've always asked a simple question. If doctors and the scientific community and the medical community is so sure that they're doing it right with each of their drugs and medical procedures, then why not do a study where you compare people who've taken their drugs or medical procedures against a group that has not and chosen a more holistic approach? In fact, I reached out at one point after visiting cancer doctors around the world over a five-year period, and all these cancer doctors had something in common. They all had been attacked and ridiculed by the American Cancer Society. At that time, they had a black book, like a McCarthy witch hunt book. And if you were in that book, oh, your reputation was destroyed. So then I went to meet the person who oversaw the book, a man named Cognum Woods, and I asked him, what does it take to get to be a quack in your book? Well, you have to have secret formulas. No one knows except you, and you have to charge a lot of money for it. And you don't have legitimate credentials, and you're not board certified, and you're never sharing your information with scientific committees, and about 15 different things. So I handed him a list of seven physicians. And I said, now these seven physicians are medical doctors, board certified, they published in the peer-reviewed literature, there's no secret to what they do, they do not charge a lot of money, some don't even charge anything. And have you ever spoken with these people? Nope. Ever read any of their work? Nope. Ever interviewed any of their patients? Nope. Then what is the basis of condemning them so the media will never approach them with an open mind, an unbiased mind? And in one case, he had some piece of information about a Dr. Joseph Issel out of some tabloid in Great Britain, and that was it. When I went to Dr. Issel's clinic, Issel was a surgeon, board-certified surgeon, he had open files, meaning any scientist or physician in the world come there and go through over 50,000 cancer patients' records. Independent of Issel's, Dr. Audier of Leiden University had done an extensive study and found that Dr. Joseph Issel's had the highest cure rate for terminal cancer of anyone in world history. It was almost 17%, 16.6%. And he had published this. Also, there was a very famous author named Gordon Higginson, and a producer for the BBC with a long history of doing outstanding work. I tracked him down in Ireland on an old country road, beautiful little home, and we talked. And he said he was very disappointed in the BBC because after he had spent a lot of time with a whole crew and medical doctors, and they visited Issel's clinic, they interviewed his patients, they reviewed the medical records, and they went all over the world researching where did Issel's patients go, how long did they live. And he found that a lot of them lived with terminal cancer before they came to Issel's, and no other treatment except Issel's, that they were alive and well with no cancer 5 years later, qualifying for being called cured. So he produced a documentary called Go Climb the Mountain. And there was an Aubrey Singer who did not want that documentary aired. So even though it was produced, and even though there was a physician that, from the Royal College that I interviewed at length about this, he supported Issels. He said the man has legitimate therapies, way beyond anything we're doing. And so it was stuck in a limbo. And then Higginson wrote an article and sent a copy to a Dutch journalist who wrote an article on it. And suddenly that caused a big scandal. So the BBC then had to air the documentary. And it was the most popular documentary that they had aired in their history. And that opened up a lot of interest in Issels' work. When I saw Issels, and he was on Tegernsee Lake, which is a major lake in Germany, he was a very tall man, long white hair. He looked like the Lion King, and he had a strong voice. But the environment itself was very calm, and he was using the most holistic modalities in the world. I visited all these other doctors, Dr. Lawrence Burton down in the Bahamas, Virginia Livingston Wheeler in San Diego, Dr. Brzezinski in Houston, Texas, Dr. Okadian in Florida, Dr. Ivisi in New York, Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, Dr. Michael Schachter. Of all the people I interviewed, no one was doing as much nor getting as positive results as Dr. Issels. So I brought all this information over to the American Cancer Society, and I shared it with them. Never one sentence of what I shared, nor was anyone ever after that interviewing any of the people involved. They didn't want to know. They had their own biases. So I thought to myself, all right, what do we have here? We have legitimate people with traditional backgrounds and degrees in the medical sciences who are getting great results. And I'm only talking about cancer now. I found it for other conditions as well. And nobody in orthodoxy wants to know about it. Why? And one Saturday afternoon, a person showed up after my radio show on WMCA. And he said, I've been listening to your show for several years now on Saturdays. And I heard you talking about cancer and how political it was. He said, I'm an oncologist. I won't tell you my name or where I work. But I just wanted to get this off my chest. He said, you're absolutely correct what you're saying. If it can't be patented and profited from, it's not going to end up being used. The protocol is all that's important, even if the patient dies. And then he told me a story. He said, frequently they'll put patients on protocols, and when they see the patient's not getting better and the protocol should be stopped or changed, they let the protocol go even when the patient dies. And he said, that's the dark side of this whole field, that a lot of the cancer people are dying from comes from the radiation or the chemotherapy or combination thereof. They won't change. They're not going to change. They don't have to change. And so we spent about an hour and a half talking, and he said, it's a club, it's a group. All the peer reviewers who review each other's work, all the different grant applications. He said, what's it like when you sit in a room with six people and they're all deciding who's going to get research for the next year, and you're one of the people seeking research funds? Are you going to say anything about their research if they can then stop your funds from coming in? He said, that unfortunately is how debased the entire field is of oncology. He said, so we've been fighting this war. And I said, it's become a medical Vietnam. That was my own experience. But I've had a lot of experience in the field. Part one of Death by Medicine, we have four parts. All will be posted on prn.fm. And we'll keep taking you further into this field to let you see the truth. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you very much for listening. Have a nice day.
Hey, what's happening?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah, brother, like,
stop right brother, brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some.